He was 25 years old. He combed his hair like James Dean. He was very fastidious. People who littered bothered him. She was 15. She took music lessons and could twirl a baton.
I'm Kit. I'm not keeping you from anything important, am I?
No.
She wasn't very popular at school. For a while, they lived together in a treehouse. In 1959, they murdered a lot of people.
Of course, I had to keep all this a secret from my dad. He would have had a fit, since Kit was 10 years older than me and came from the wrong side of the track, so-called.
I don't want you to hang around anymore. I don't want to see you again. Understand?
Then, sure enough, Dad found out I'd been running around behind his back. He was madder than I'd ever seen him. He made me take extra music lessons every day after school and wait there till he came to pick me up. He said that if the piano didn't keep me off the streets, maybe the clarinet would.
My girl Holly and I decided to kill ourselves, same way I did her dad. Nobody's coming out of this thing happy, especially not us. I can't deny we've had fun, though.
We hid out in the wilderness, down by a river in a grove of cottonwoods. It'd be in the flood season. We built our house in the trees. We planned a huge network of tunnels under the forest floor, and our first order of business every morning was to decide on a new password. He gave me lectures on how a gun works, how to take it apart and put it back together again, in case I had to carry on without him. He said that if the devil came at me, I could shoot him with a gun.
Hey.
Listen to your parents and teachers. They got a line on most things, so don't treat them like enemies. There's always an outside chance you can learn something. Try to keep an open mind. Try to understand the viewpoints of others.
I think I got
him. I don't know.
Well, I'm not going down there and look.
Consider the minority opinion. But try to get along with the majority of opinion once it's accepted. Of course, Holly and I have had fun, even if it has been rushed. So far, we're doing fine. Hadn't got caught. Excuse the grammar.
Come with us now, if you dare, down a rickety staircase into a dank, dark basement. What awaits? The Saturday Night Freak Show.
Welcome back, ladies and germs, to the Saturday Night Freak Show podcast. It happens every Saturday night. You can't avoid it.
I can't avoid it.
Love it, because we're out for world domination. We're taking over your internet radios. My name is Colin. I'm surrounded by the internet radio superstars.
This is Brent.
Travis.
Gary.
Welcome back again, Gary.
Thank you. Welcome back.
And tonight we watched Brent's pick of...
We watched Badlands.
From the year
1973.
Directed by
Terrence Malick.
Starring
Martin Sheen and Sissy Spacek.
Running time.
Hold on, I got it. It is 94 minutes long.
And in glorious color.
In color with monaural 1.85 to 1 aspect ratio. Is monaural, that's the sound, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
All mono sound.
Mono sound.
But it comes to us from the Criterion Collection. That was a very nice disc.
Ooh, it was very expensive.
Yeah. Ooh, no,
it was free.
It was free.
Why? Oh, come on.
I got it free.
I wouldn't.
Why did I pick this movie?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, Terrence Malick has always been... I don't know, since Thin Red Line, I've liked his work. He hasn't done a lot, but I think I've seen everything since then. So this was like the one that I was still, like, I had always heard of Badlands, but I'd never seen it. And then I saw a clip of it at one point, and I noticed it had the voiceover and the same exact music. Well, not exact, but almost the same music from True Romance, which is another favorite film of mine. So I started becoming more and more curious about it, and, you know, finally I figured this was the venue to show it. It's probably been, I don't know, it's been in the back of my mind showing it ever since we started the podcast, but now it just seemed like the right time for
whatever reason. It's been in the back of your mind to show it, but you hadn't actually seen it.
Right.
This is like a blind buy.
Yeah, yeah. I was pulling a Tom. I was just going to get it and then show it. And we would all discover it and experience it together.
It wasn't bad.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, yeah.
I hadn't seen it before.
Yeah,
I've always liked those 70s kind of like, not necessarily true crime, but, you know, kind of true crime, just kind of normal, whatever.
I do have a confession to make. I did watch it before before I came here tonight.
Liar.
Was that in preparation? You were doing a little like...
I just couldn't wait. Yeah, I mean, this goddamn box is sitting on my shelf, and I'm like, I got to watch this. I've got, you know, I think it was like last Wednesday, maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Well, give us an overview really quick what it's about, and I guess we can get into talking about the movie. What is Badlands about?
Badlands is about burning love on the Great Plains in 1959.
I would say it's not about that.
Well, right. And we will definitely get into that, but on the box, that's what it says.
Oh, you're using the...
the promotional material.
Yeah, the... they're never going to say, it's an okay movie. Tell your friends that you think would like it. You know?
it's about a unique individual, a young man, living and working in South Dakota. He's kind of a James Dean-like type. I would say, almost kidnaps this young girl, says he's in love with her, and they go off on the road. He kills her father, and then they just start a crime spree.
Pretty much anybody that would be a witness.
Yeah.
Anybody like, we need to stay here. Sorry. You know?
Start shooting them.
But, like, she, like, Sissy Spacek, I would almost say, like, I don't know, it doesn't necessarily feel like, she just figures, oh, you know, I'd either be like, I don't know, she's kind of a fucking sociopath or something. Like,
I think she gets to that point. Yeah. Well, yeah, even with her father.
I think, too, you got to look at it. She's 15 years old in the movie, so she's way mentally underdeveloped. And then you got a guy who's 25, doesn't seem very much more mentally developed than she is, very impulsive, very reckless. She falls in love. And, you know, girls back then, when you fell in love with a guy, you just did whatever he wanted. You know, he was right, and you just followed along.
Yeah. I also like the way that, like, you know, when they first meet, he says, you know, something about, let's go for a walk. I got stuff to say. You know, a lot of people don't seem to have anything going on in their heads. But, and then whenever you see him, he's just got this blank stare. Like, the entire way through the movie, like, that's he's just staring. He's got those vacant, you know, kind of eyes.
Yeah.
That's not to say he's not charismatic, but that's another thing, I guess.
Well, and yeah, it's interesting because, like, what Gary's saying, you know, about a girl at that, because it takes place in 59, and a young girl, she's going to listen to the male authority figure in her life. And the first thing that Kit is Martin Sheen's character.
Yes.
The first thing that he does is kill her father. So he's the only, you know, male authority figure that is in her life.
You think she'd freak out a little bit more than just slapping him once?
Well, but Dad, let's face it, Dad had a few quirks, you know, punishing the girl by taking her pet dog out in the field and shooting it because she's running 50s. Around with Kit.
Yeah.
No, lucky he just didn't, like, rape her, like, well, like, yeah, as punishment,
I'll
you know?
Give you that, yeah.
You dirty whore, no, I'll, you know.
Well, and then, like, you know, he threw the dog off of the bridge in the bag like it was a mafia hit. You know,
right.
You know, so I think she grew up with a little bit of violence. Dad seemed a little unhinged, you know, himself, you know. Yeah. So I think that kind of may have desensitized her a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Kit come along, it just seemed like it was the normal thing to do.
Well, it even seemed like he kind of, you know, Kit, again, doesn't start off this movie as a serial killer. But, you know, you can tell that there's a hole in this guy somewhere. There's a void. He's a trash collector or something, kind of aimless. He gets fired from that. Then
he
like,
just does what he wants. I mean, that's what you get from this guy, that he doesn't give a fuck about, like, rules or, like, what's expected out of society. Yeah, he's just, like, collecting trash. He's like, well, I'm done for the day. You know, he just, like, walks off.
Enough.
You know?
No, you're fired.
Yeah, you're fired. All right, well,
you know. Heard the headlines.
Yeah, I love the way that guy, says that. Talk all over town.
What's that?
Well,
you're fired.
And then Sheen's takes his keys. He's like, well, I guess I won't be needing these. I'll keep them in a safe place for you, and drafts them in like a bucket of paint or something.
It was oil.
Oil.
But I mean, I don't want to give the impression to the listener that, like, you know, that this guy's like some hard-edged criminal. He's like the most polite, charismatic kind of, you know, even though he's, you know, distant, doesn't care about the rules.
He's a delinquent.
Yeah.
He's a juvenile delinquent.
Kind of guy you could sit around, have a beer with and a conversation, but yeah, that's there's that underlying current in him as well, you know, that you don't see until it's too late.
Yeah.
But I think he is kind of like Charles Manson muttering to himself. I kind of do, you know, because I mean, like he tells her, like, oh, listen to me, you know, I got shit to say or whatever. But by the end of it, you know, she quits listening to him because, yeah, he's just always rambling about some shit, you know?
Yeah. And he, his psychosis is kind of identified early on. The entire movie is narrated by Sissy Spacek's character, so we know by the fact that she's narrating it that she survives at the end. We know that this ends in the Badlands, you know, and that the story is going to come to an end. But she, at one point, is explaining that, you know, what, because there's a period here of courtship or whatever before the violence happens that, you know, they actually do seem to be like, you know, teenagers in love kind of thing, awkwardly. But, you know, still, I think that's one of the movie's strengths is it plays it kind of realistic and just kind of, you know, awkward. But she says, you know, when Kit would lie in bed at night, he would tell me that he would see, or he had like the sound of a seashell pressed to his ear, and then he would see visions of me in white robes coming to him, you know, I'm reading that as like, oh, okay, so that's him, you know, hallucinating, you know.
What if he's just BSing her? What if he's telling her some romantic shit? You know what I mean? I mean, but it's not far beyond this character.
That's true. But I guess in the context of the movie, and that's why I wonder if like that was how I, as the audience, was supposed to read it. It's like, okay, that's showing that's foreshadowing that this guy's, you know, kind of loopy.
Well, yeah. The one thing that threw me was how she said her cold hand against his head. So to me, I took that as maybe she was an apparition of death to him.
Or maybe. You know,
that's kind of how I read that.
Yeah.
That could be too.
That's why I just take him as a Manson character. He's just sitting there, like, muttering whatever thoughts, like, run through, like, oh, my, you know, the birds, you know.
Yeah. Well, the idea of, like, romance in this film, it's vacant. There is no romance in a film that, you know, on the box says Burning Love. It's not romantic in the sense of these, or it's not passionate, I guess. There's a romance to the idea.
I think that's what it is. It's the romance of the living beyond the law, living, right? Like, you know, it's a rebellious type of love sort of deal thing where,
yeah,
she's with the hot guy because she says she's like, oh, this guy could get any girl if he just gave it a, you know, some time, you know. So she's kind of just thrilled to be with the dude, you know, because she's timid or whatever, piano player or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And he's showing her, like, you know, attention, I guess, is like a magnetic draw.
And he's like 25, another thing in this movie. She's 15, he's 25, so there's another, like...
Yeah.
Well, and he hits her with the special, you know, I like you not just to have sex. That's not why I even like you. So, you know, he makes her feel special and...
Right.
And she follows along. But I think it shows with the romance part, at least, it does seem to blossom very quickly, has that intense spark for a little bit, but then you can quickly see it dying out.
Yeah,
too.
Real quick.
You know, like you said, she's getting annoyed with him. She's kind of sick of him. Even the first time they have sex, after they're done, she's like, well, that was it. And well, I don't see what everybody's talking about. So, it just was very, you know, matter of fact, like, oh, well, glad we got that out of the way.
Yeah.
So, yeah. The romance, I guess that's a little overplayed.
Yeah, because it's almost like you almost don't get the idea that this is a sexual, like, relationship. I mean, aside from that scene, which we don't see. We see the, you know, moments following. But then after that, it's like, it doesn't feel like it's a, you know, a hot, passionate sexual relationship. It's like they love each other, you know, but it's kind of like, it's almost just that kind of codependency or whatever that, you know, we exist in this space and we're the only two people here, you know, I suppose like that goes into what you're saying. That's the romance of the idea. We're the last two people on earth. It's us against the world.
It's the Bonnie and Clyde type of romance.
Yeah. Well, and another thing I took, like after Kit had killed her father and they burned down the house. And of course, they're only going to find one set of bones. So they know they're still alive. So he's not exactly a genius criminal.
Yeah.
But when they went and they built their little treehouse.
It was the 50s. You didn't have to be.
Right. But they went and they built their little treehouse. Honestly, and as she's narrating and they're showing some of the visuals on that, you know, some of the pictures of nature and some of the tight shots. it almost reminded me of more like Ponyboy and Johnny in The Outsiders when they ran away to the church. Yeah, that's kind of what it reminded me of.
Yeah.
So that you know, and that has that same kind of a feel to it, that era.
But. Yeah, and I was going to say that reminded me of Neverland, you know, or like the Lost Boys, because they're just out there existing in this world that they created, but there's not like any sort
I'll go with Swiss Family Robinson. There it reminded me of Swiss Family Robinson, another famous treehouse story.
Just real quick, we've been talking a lot about Wes Anderson lately. That whole campsite scene reminded me exactly of Moonrise Kingdom. Like that had to have been, this movie had to have been an influence on that for sure.
Huh.
I'm thinking.
I don't know.
Did you see that? Mm-mm. No?
Okay. No, not yet.
It's good. Well, I mean, and maybe this is diverting the topic from the movie for a moment to talk about like the director, but, and I noticed that like as much as Travis brings up Superman, I think I bring up Quentin Tarantino because like I see Quentin Tarantino in this movie as in like Tarantino saw this fucking movie and he went and wrote Natural Born Killers and he used the music in this for True Romance. And at the end, there's like this car chase where, which I thought was like expertly done. I mean, it's like, it's in this drama and then all of a sudden there's a chase and it's not like an overblown Hollywood kind of thing. It's exciting because it like just suddenly where it comes from, it's like suddenly there's the cops. And like,
it's all the dust that kicked up.
Well, yeah.
As soon as I was watching, I was like, this is why Mad Max wails. Cars in dirt kicking up dust, slamming into each other.
Well, and the actual sounds, not the overproduced sounds of a lot of the new car chases, not the squealing tires. It's just, you can hear the engines revving and, like you said, the dirt kicking up. It just really makes you feel like you're watching a real car chase.
Yeah.
That was a fun scene. That's probably the funnest part of this movie was that scene.
Yeah, I mean, as far as like a visceral reaction, I mean, the rest of it is like, and you know, knowing other Malick movies, have you seen Days of Heaven?
I have not.
Okay, I don't think I've seen any of his movies. I swear,
Thin Red Line.
I've never seen that.
New World, Tree of Life.
Seen that.
Yeah,
what was that? He had something else recently, didn't he?
So he's got four movies.
Well, that's what's like, weird about this guy. He like Badlands and Days of Heaven. I want to say like either got Academy Award nominations or won maybe something for actor. I don't know, but
we're checking the box.
He kind of shot to some level of like, you know, artistic integrity and then like went silent for like a number of years. And this is one of these guys.
He wouldn't join the Illuminati.
Like Kubrick, like you could not pick him out of a crowd because I think there's one photo of him that they show. And like, because I was a fan of The New World. I bought that one. I was watching it and all the documentary stuff. It's like they don't show the director. He's camera shy or something. He's like a super shy guy, I guess. So there's this one photo of him in like a cowboy hat that like that's the only picture of Terrence Malick that I've ever seen in my life, you know, like if you ever go looking for him. But I'm looking at like an evolution of style here because like when I look at the first movie of his that I saw was The Thin Red Line. And at the time, I didn't really appreciate it. And I haven't really gone back to it since because I had like a negative experience with it. But what I got out of it that he was doing really well was all of these like the way that he would compare like war and nature or nature's indifference.
And he does that with this, right?
Yeah. But not as much. I mean, that's where I'm like seeing
this. I thought he totally did. Well, I can't say not as much because I haven't seen a lot. But I just noticed that. That's why we were outside talking. I call this an art house movie, even though I don't necessarily mean it's independent and would only be shown in an art theater, blah, 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 blah. But just the idea that there's a lot of like nature, like macro photography of like just still images, you know, with some weird like choir music going on.
Yeah.
You should see the Tree of Life. Well, you may not like it. I don't know, because it's like he took. I was actually surprised now going back, you know, because I've seen like his recent stuff and he has a style. Like Terrence Malick has now a Terrence Malick style.
Big time.
That he developed. And so you go back and look at this because I think this is his first movie.
I believe so, yeah.
This is more like a narrative, you know, it has a stronger narrative structure, I think, than anything that he does now. I mean, you look at The Thin Red Line or The New World or The Tree of Life and they're like, they just kind of take their time and go off in all these like detours and tangents. And, you know, I remember watching The Tree of Life. It was like, it's an interesting experience more than it is a good movie. It's an emotional experience. It's a powerful experience, but it's kind of like your mind wanders during the movie because there's nothing happening. It's just like, you know, these kind of pastoral shots of swing sets and tree. I mean, yeah. You know, when we saw the Man of Steel trailer for the first time, I was like, it's like Terrence Malick directed, you know, Man of Steel, these shots of, you know, cornfields and, you know, laundry in the wind. And I forgot where I was going with that. Well, totally lost it.
It's like, who's the artist? The American artist did all the papers, the covers.
Oh, yeah.
Norman Saturday Rockwell.
Evening, Norman Rockwell. Thank you.
Saturday Evening.
It's like Ricana.
It's like Rockwell meets Salvador Dali. I mean, it's almost like this. It's this, you know, it's a totally like a visceral, like a neurological experience watching one of his films. Like he almost like, I don't know if you're identifying with the pictures or the images or if you're going inside his brain or he's trying to get inside your brain, mm-hmm. but like there is the narrative is out the window.
Yeah.
For the most part. I mean, I think progressively, because this, like you said, is the most narrative, but like Thin Red Line there is still there, you know, I mean, I think they're taking that hill for goddamn half the film, right?
Even so, it has a lack of plot.
There's
where other movies are more concerned with plot. What is it, character? See, I don't know. It's like it's kind of elliptical in the way that he deals with stuff. It's like he does something and then, you know, comes back to it a little while later. Then it comes back to it a little while later, and in the meantime, he's doing all these other. And
it's like, more of a circular storytelling. It just keeps going around, or
well, as far as I mean, like themes and stuff or character building, where you just see like a little bit of the character here, then you know, we don't develop that any further, we go off and do something else, and then we'll come back to like doing something about the character, and then you go off and do something else, and then come back again, you know?
Yeah,
and you're, as I was saying with Tree of Life, not so much with this one, but with Tree of Life, you know, in the New World, your mind wanders, you know, while you're watching it. And I began to wonder, is like, is that on purpose? Is he trying to make like movies some kind of interactive thing where like your thought process figures into the experience of watching the movie because you have so much time to just behold the images and, you know, be transported to whatever, you know, you're looking at or whatever, you know, memories from your own past and, you know, your feelings toward that picture that come to mind. Like that becomes part of the experience of watching the Terrence Malick movie.
Question, did that help the movie? Okay, because like watching this, you know, the shots of like, I mean, it didn't necessarily like.
I think this is still so early on, he hasn't quite mastered that.
I think it definitely came through in Thin Red Line because to me, it kind of showed how even in the middle of war, there's still beauty. And it's still, you know, there's other things affected besides just the men on the battlefield. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, that's
and that's what I got from that. So I think really, it definitely got better by then.
There was an awesome scene in there, which in Thin Red Line, in Thin Red Line, that started off with like, you know, leaves on tree, then another leaf, and then here's a caterpillar, and then like all of a sudden a raindrop would hit one, and you know, and then you see the caterpillar like flopping around on the. On the leaf, and then like another drop, and then you see like the grass, and another drop, and then all of a sudden the rain starts, and then after that, like it cuts right to like shelling, mm-hmm. artillery shelling, and all these guys running around. It was like, wow, that's actually kind of,
And I always took it as like showing nature is going to exist, like you know, man is like the animals are just doing the same thing they do every day. Mm-hmm. Man is coming in. They're going to have these battles. They're going to come and go. Nature's still going to exist. Like they're not really changing.
It's anything. Like indifferent to man.
Yeah.
Nature continues to just grow and do its own stuff.
Right.
And all these people think their stuff is so important. And it's like, you know, maybe that's, you know.
That's what I felt about Badlands.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was these characters were indifferent. Oh, even Sissy Spacek, indifferent. Because mm-hmm. she's just like, you killed my father. Killed him. All right, I'll get in the car. You know, I mean, it's just like.
She did say, how do you think he's doing?
Well, yeah.
That's how he's doing.
It's really funny. Like, I don't know. It'd be like if I shot one of you right now, sat down and be like, should we get that looked at?
Yeah.
All right. No, I don't think we got to bother. Even, just go check yourself.
Yeah, even when the dad comes home and he's like, what are you doing in my house? Like, that's about as emotional as anyone in this film gets. Like, when the guy gets shot out in the field, his buddy, he stumbles back to his bed and just kind of sits there laying on his bed. Just ready, waiting to die like he expected it.
Well, and I love how she said, well, he said we should never talk about it because it'd bring us bad luck. Well, yeah, murdering people usually does bring you bad luck. You wind up in the electric chair. That's pretty bad luck. So, yeah. But the thing is, like you said, with the murders and the way she reacted, especially, very calm. But I wonder if they played it that way on purpose. Like, she was kind of mentally not there, you know, because of her age, I think, is what they're saying.
Well, she says that at one point, that, like, you know, all this has been going on and, you know, I didn't feel this way or that way. I just kind of felt blah. So, you know, is that speaking to, like, you know, disaffected youth or something like that? I mean, I think her age clearly, you know, has something to do with it. You know, her isolation as a person, you know, in her family life or community life, you know, up until then. But I think also, I think, you know, you would expect someone to react to some of these things. And I think they're showing
you. She has to be a sociopath.
Yeah, she has to be a little fucked up.
Well, she did say after her mom died that her dad never adjusted to the little stranger in his house, meaning her. So she probably didn't have a whole lot of emotional attachment to dad.
Yeah.
Although then later on it did show they were kind of playful, you know, when they was painting the sign and stuff. But still, I don't think there's a whole lot of attachment.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, he killed her dog, for God's sake.
Yeah, nothing scared. Girl with daddy issues.
I just wonder if in the 50s, if that was you know, because I mean, we're talking like a rural community, too, where you probably shot dogs all the
time. That's what you did. You're like, shoot those dogs. Fucking running around barking all night.
Well, yeah, I mean,
shoot them.
The first thing you see in the film, I think, is, or one of the first things, is the dead dog. And he's like, give you a dollar to eat that collie.
Collie, yeah. You know? I don't think that's a collie. I don't care what it is. I ain't eating it for a dollar.
That's
the 60s, man.
But I think that the Martin Sheen character, Kit, is wise beyond his years. And where that comes from, I don't know, is ever really explained.
I don't think he is wise beyond his years. I don't.
Everything he's talking about, like, whenever
but his actions, that's what I'm saying. It's like his actions are not thought out whatsoever. So how fucking smart really is he?
Well,
I mean, yeah, he can sit there and extrapolate about, you know, I can't even remember what he was talking about in the movie. He's just talking about, well, we're almost caught now. We had to shoot him. I'm sorry about that. But, you know, like, I just don't recall anything really, like, insightful he said.
Well,
kids, listen to your parents. Because parents and teachers.
Right.
Because they're not always. Because and I love the technology in this movie. There's a
the
moment,
Vitaphone.
Yeah. What was it? What it was called? The Vitaphone. It
looks like he made the little 45.
Yeah. It looks like a phone booth. So this must have existed. And this is a technology that I was unaware of.
It was only 50 cents.
50 cents to go into a phone booth with this machine that, you know, it records, you can record a message
fucking lays on down
45
wax.
A wax record. And the little light is like ticking down, like, this is how much time you have. I'm like, that's fantastic.
That's so cool because it's like 30 seconds left, 15, 10, you know, like these little lights blink on and off. It was so cool.
Man. Well, I had heard of the dictaphone before, but I had never seen the other technology.
Yeah, that was
right.
I mean, I knew that you could do stuff like that in record stores and stuff. I didn't know there was a, you know, like a portable one in like an airport, but a bus station.
Yeah.
Well, I wish it had shown like somebody get one of these messages, right? Because I like that idea that each place you stop, you're leaving like a little piece of the puzzle, like where you're at, right?
That's like the romance behind it. He's in love with the idea of being on the run from the cops and leaving them these clues. It's a game in his head.
He's leaving them a souvenir. He's also a souvenir collector. When they have sex, he takes a rock. He builds a rock, you know, at his last stand or whatever. And
takes the hat.
Rocks it.
You know, what's interesting is
mementos.
Each stop that they make is like a class, like a societal class, like progression. So they start out in the woods, right? In the Neverland forest, they're basically homeless, living off the land or cavemen. And then they go up to, like, I would say it's lower class.
A little shack.
Out in the farm. And then, do they go right to the rich guy's house next?
Yeah, they kidnap. Yeah. There's, like, two folks, which I can only imagine were, like, because he said he, what was that guy's name? Cato? Or I forget.
Cato, yep.
Yeah, something like that. He said something about watching the place for some folks. And then two people show up there asking for Cato. It's like, I can only imagine those are the people?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, they just steal their car, put them in the cellar or whatever. And then, they go right to the rich person's house.
And we never know what happened to those two guys, that couple.
Yeah.
Well, that was kind of cool. I kind of like that scene where, he's like, we're not going to hurt you. Just, you know, don't come out for an hour. Then as he shuts it. He like shoots twice through the little whatever. He's like, "You think I got him? I'm not gonna check." I thought that was kind of like cool.
Well, that's suspenseful a little bit. You know, because your point of view is ingrained so much with the characters. Only when Sissy Spacek telling you what the outside world thinks of their spree, which you're assuming she's getting through like newspapers or something like that, you're so in with them that you just see them committing these acts, and you don't find out what the fallout of it is. You know, I think they were either used to kind of getting that almost instantaneous.
There's always a cop character investigating.
The next scene, right?
Always.
Well, we get, they killed them, you know?
These two crazy bastards.
And you had that Boston detective that showed you he was a master detective by pointing at the bench or whatever.
Oh, that's so great.
That's where they sit.
Yeah.
I love that footage because it's like actual probably 16mm footage or something. But
it's like a newsreel or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But in 73, I'm sure that's what it looked like. But today we try so hard to recreate shots like that. You know, like that old looking footage.
Well, they definitely did it with the new Texas chainsaws when they tried to show the found or the footage when they're going through the house. They tried to do that.
Yeah.
Yep.
But it's like always overproduced. You look at this, it's so simple. You know, it still looks old to me now. You know, like that was what they were going for. It's like here's the black and white kind of mildly scratched film of the newsreel footage.
Right.
Yeah. But what were you saying about the class, you know,
I don't know. I mean, it's commenting on something. It's, you know, it's the
societal class.
Societal
like
class.
You
class.
Said he's commenting on it. You got to tell me what it is, sir.
Well, okay. Let's figure it out. Because if you want to say when they're out in the woods, that let's say that's lower class. Let's say when they go to the ranch, that's middle class. And then the, you know, that rich guy's house is obviously upper class.
That's also the human journey, isn't it? You go from like the jungle to like the hut to the house,
like through evolution or through
societal evolution, I suppose so.
But he also seemed, did he get less violent as he went through?
No way.
It seemed like he that kind of shot. Well, he shot less people toward the end of the movie than he did.
But he didn't need to shoot those two people in the cellar, and he did anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't aim at him. He didn't, like, execute him, but he still fucking wanted to kill him.
Yeah.
You know, that's why, like, to me, this is almost like a realistic version of Rebel Without a Cause. It's that you get into a situation that expands, and there's nowhere to go but down, right? Mm-hmm. There's just nowhere to, I mean, they're just going to run forever until they get caught.
Well, yeah, and he says that a couple times.
Well, yeah, that's what I thought. I was so weird about this movie when he does just give himself up at the, you know, at the end of that car.
He'd shoot it out.
I thought that was so weird. And, you know, I kind of like that about the character. He's like, well, I like how earlier when they're in the woods and the bounty hunters come after him, it's like he doesn't mind killing them because, you know, they're not, like, doing a job or, you know, whatever. They're just looking to kidnap them, you know,
but isn't that
turn them
kinda,
in for money.
Don't you think he's just telling that to Sissy Spacek just, you know, to, like, that's his, you know, a scapegoat. Oh, they were.
No,
you know,
see, I think that's the true. That's a truism because
you think
I mean,
he believes it. You mean?
Yeah, because at the end he does. He gives himself. I mean, he shoots that cop to get away, but once he knows he's caught, he's like, "All right, I give up." You know, you guys did a good race. You know, we had a.
Did he say something specific about where it was like when you're what was it when you were playing for keeps? You know, it's okay to, what was it?
It's okay to shoot any witnesses,
but you have to be prepared to take the consequences.
Yeah, you got
to
accept it.
So that's
it.
Like, you know.
But he also said when he shot the bounty hunters, he told Sissy Spacek, but if it was, it would be different if it was a police officer because he had a job to do.
Right.
Yeah, he
but
was
that
doing
didn't
job.
Seem to matter when
these
he's gone
to
Captain America's shield and ran at the cop blazing with the gun.
That's true.
So
right?
I don't know where he came up with that idea, but that wasn't going to stop a bullet.
Well, that was an interesting. Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
I'm just going to say real quick that I think at that by that point, and maybe I don't think he had a plan. I agree with Travis. He didn't know what he was doing. But towards the end, I think he accepted the fact that he was going to get caught because he's talking about, you know, like, oh, today's the day. You know, I thought it was going to be today. And then him going out in a blaze of glory or, you know, seeing it to the end to the electric chair. One way or another, that was like his finishing his story. And he was romance. He was in love with that because he knew it was going to get to that point at some point. That's, I think, why he gives up after the car chase. You know, it's like, I got to get a car chase in there because that's going to make a great story. But at the same time, he's ready to do the rest of it, you know, because he's like, there was something that he was saying, like, I wonder if I'm going to be able to hear
when the eulogy at my funeral.
Yeah.
But he didn't want to die. The
next day, well, he's kind of an egotist.
Yeah.
I mean, he got off when people said he looks like James Dean.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah,
he
absolutely.
Wanted to, that's why I was like, this is like a rebel without a cause, like a more realistic, because, yeah, he just wants to. It's like, this is your ideal, or at least maybe he had an idea of what being this, like, rebel juvenile delinquent on the run is, you know, but then living with Sissy Spacek and just figuring out they got to live in dirt. They got to live like animals. You know, I like that part, Sissy Spacek, where she's just like, I want to take a bath. You know, I just want to eat something that's, you know.
Yeah. Well, you got to think, too, a kid that age in that era, he grew up watching movies about Dillinger and all the old gangster movies. So that's what they kind of,
Yeah, he's the Scarface lover of his day.
Yeah.
When we were talking about, you know, the love story, and I'm going back, I guess, a little bit, but when we were talking about the love story between them, did you guys find it odd that, like, in her narration, at one point where she's like with this guy, she's talking about, like, you know, one day I wonder what the man I'm going to marry is going to look like.
Yeah.
Is he thinking about me right now?
I don't know it.
See, I didn't think that was odd because he says about her, like, if she, you know, when he's talking to that, it's like, if she just wants to take off, she'll just take off, whatever, you know? Because it is kind of that, this is like that fucking Bob Seger Night Moves, you know? It's like these two are just fucking and, like, raising hell just because they're young and they're free. Other than that, they're really not, like, actually, this is not about law. It's about freedom. That's what it's about.
Well, and when
it's freedom, when, that might actually be like really close on point to what this movie is about. Maybe you think, I don't know, because I mean that's basically the thing. He does go to her father. You know, her father's like, "Don't see this boy anymore." You know, so this is like all love stories are doomed. Don't, you know? He goes to the father, and the father says, "Stay away from my daughter. I want you to, you know, I don't want to see you again." Which, to which I say, like, when the hell has that ever worked? Ever, fathers out there. Unfortunately, it's the rule of the law of the land or whatever. But, you know, so he did everything, like, you know, he's a very polite psychopath, you know, where he is keenly aware of, like, you know, he's like the rich guy who he doesn't kill when they're in that house. He gives him a receipt of the stuff that he stole from.
So he can make an insurance claim is what I took that as.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like, what the... Yeah. I mean, he's very cordial, and eventually that, like, plays into, you know, toward the end. Like,
but as they're leaving the house, he's like, you know, the cops are going to be able to match up that handwriting of what I left that guy. So he's just, like, getting his
idea of
kicks
it,
off.
Of the criminal procedure, too, I think, a little bit, because you see him wiping for handprints and things like that.
Yeah.
You know.
Which he gets better at.
Yeah.
You get the impression that he's in, you know, because, I mean, like, when you brought up Night Moves, I get the, you know, that to me conjures an idea of, like, people who are, it conjures to mind Mickey and Mallory, to be honest with you. You know, like, they're in love with what they're doing and want to kill people. And, like, yeah, like, we're just, you know, setting the world on fire. Where these guys, I didn't get the impression that they were in love with, you know, killing people. He was just easy at it, you know, like, well, you offend me or you stand in my way. I asked your dad, you know, for your hand or whatever, you know, let her, you see me. And he said no, so I shot him because I want this freedom. I want freedom to be able to live my life without any kind of rules and constraints. And so we're just going to go and drive around in a car. So, like, that's what I want. These people stand in the way. Well, I know how society is. You got to put them down. Because otherwise they're going to keep us, you know, apart. We're not going to be able to live with
them. And I like what he said in his, I think, when he was talking in the dictaphone, where he talks about how his dad told him how you got to, like, live life the way you want to, but you got to see how the rest of the world lives and kind of match up to that, you know. So he is kind of a chameleon type character who just, he sees, oh, you're a religious dude. Yeah, religion's cool. You know, he just, that way you're not seen as, you know, someone that's, you know,
yeah,
whatever.
It's like, says, like, go with the mass or question the mass opinion or something like that. Or, but if no, it seems once, reasonable,
yeah, it was like, once it's something, if it's agreed upon, go try to go with, you know, what's agreed upon.
Yeah,
but I thought that was like him just giving, like,
I thought that was like a Dexter thing, kind of like a just go with it, you know, this is your.
See, I didn't get that as, I guess I didn't read it that way, that he was like, you know, like. You know, because Dexter is always, like, talking to us, the audience, like, this is what I do to, you know, be a chameleon and live within society. I got the impression that this guy actually believed everything that he was saying. Again, like, you know, he was totally, like, this polite guy. Like, you know what, kids, if you're listening to this, you know, don't give your teachers and your parents so much slack, you know, because eventually, you know, against their will, they may give you good ideas. So this is like advice.
It's a cautionary tale. It's a public service announcement from a spree killer.
Freaking, what's his name? Doug Jones or Jones? Damn it,
Jim Jones.
Jim Jones. He's telling you another like '60s, '70s thing. The cult leader guy that can just talk all the kids into killing for him.
Now there's a movie called The Sacrament, I think, which is based on that, kind of loosely based on it.
Well, you had touched on about what he had said about his father. Sissy Spacek, at that one point when she's looking at her father's picture, says almost the same thing. You know, I realize I'm only here for so much time, and it sent a shiver down my spine. And that's what I think it is. They fall in love with life and rebelling and getting what you want because you never know when it's all over.
Yeah.
So right. I think it's the American outlaw thing. Yeah. You know?
I love that line when they're leaving the rich guy's house, and he's like, and this rich guy thought that money was going to solve all his problems, and it didn't, you know, because we showed up, we mixed things up and, you know, basically took over their house for a couple hours.
But. Well, and when they were leaving too, and he like grabbed Sissy Spacek's ass, and he's like, anybody ever do that to you before? And she's like, no. And it's almost like he was trying to find reasons. I thought for a while he was going to try and get rid of her because he felt like it was dying out.
Because
that scene, I think it was when they were out in the looking at the mountains.
Yeah.
And they're in the backseat kissing. That was the most awkward kissing scene I have ever seen in a movie. Neither one of them looked like they really wanted to be kissing the other one. It didn't feel. And you definitely felt that the romance was dead at that point.
That was the moment.
Her, because that's what she was just saying, how, like, you know, well, could I get away or would I get, you know. So, I mean, she was definitely contemplating at that point, like, how the hell am I going to get out of this situation, you know, with
this
guy.
But again, to characterize this, you know, for, I guess, people who haven't seen this, it doesn't come across like she's fighting against it at every...
Well, but there's nowhere to run, though. I mean, she's in the middle of nowhere with this one dude who probably does all the hunting.
Yeah.
Obviously, he's a survivalist.
Yeah. So a dependency.
I think it's a dependency. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the only reason she went with him. She's like, my dad's dead. It's either spend my life alone.
She says that.
Yeah.
When they leave the school.
At least hang out with this hot dude for a while or be alone and miserable. So, I think it's all dependency, you know?
She tells the...
She's actually a weak woman character. I like it.
Because the rich guy, she told, like, you know, it's like that she actually thought that Kit was crazy.
Off his bean.
I hope it never happens to me.
Yeah, I think that ship sailed. Like,
so but you mean, that, yeah.
think he's crazy.
But also, like, it's the whole, like, I don't know, it's the no honor amongst thieves. You know, I like that idea that even though they're thick as thieves, you know, they actually talk against each other. You know, they don't necessarily know each other's motives or... Doesn't she even say that in the movie about how, or does... Or does Martin Sheen say that about how you never really know somebody? Oh, she was talking about how she didn't think he would be such a violent person, but then how easily she saw how trigger happy he was. It goes to show you can never really know somebody.
Mm. Yeah. And that's around the time, because that's when they're at the ranch, and then they go to the house.
Yeah, after they kill Kato.
So it's the Woods Ranch House I'm referring to.
The I'm going to make a stance and say there is no significance to the order of where they're staying. This is just my stance, though. Yeah, I'm just going to say that. Yeah.
That's fair enough. But that, like, her sociopathological ways.
Pathic? I don't know.
Sociopathic ways. They get stronger and stronger to the point where, like, you guys are talking about when they're in the house and she's like, you know, I hope I never lose my noodle or whatever.
Yeah, bean.
My bean.
Yeah.
But she's strolling around the house and, like Gary, you were saying, it's the ship has sailed. By that point, she is as far gone as he is, you know, not as violent, but... Like, she doesn't give a
shit.
She's
just comfortable with it. Because I like she's like, I like your house.
Yeah.
She's talking to him like a normal person when he's, like, sitting there with a maid, like, don't shoot him.
Well, she's hanging out with the one... Okay, so the people who show up at Kato's house, this guy and this girl.
Yeah.
She walks the girl, because Kit's like, you better come with me out into this field. So the guy and Kit go away at gunpoint. Yeah. So the girl's not under gunpoint. And Sissy Spacek walks with her, and she's like, you know, what does she say?
She goes, are you in love?
Yeah.
I was, like, freaked out by that. I'm like, this is fucking scary. I would not, like, want someone
to be walked out into
in the middle of them be like, so
that.
You love her?
Yeah.
Huh? Like, someone trying to get, like, a gauge on your personality so they could take it with them in their fucking, like, murder bag of, you know.
And then she gets upset with her, because I forget what the girl says, but... you know, she's identifying with Kit at that point, and she says, what does she say?
Well,
she's
the, like, girl, the girl says, goes, what's going to happen to us?
Right, yeah.
Oh, it just depends on what Kit says. I don't know. So she's very, very fucking... She's compliant. She's
And she says that Kit feels trapped. Haven't you ever felt like that?
I thought she said she felt trapped.
No, she said... She said him. Kit. She said Kit feels trapped. Haven't you ever felt like that?
I need to be by his side.
Which I kind of... Yeah. See, I kind of understand that, too. There's kind of that, like... Well, I mean, once again, Rebel Without a Cause. This movie's Rebel Without a Cause.
But when you have somebody that's a sociopath like Sheen's character is in this movie, they know what to look for. You know, they're looking for that weak girl that'll go along with what they say. They know how to hunt just like anything else. You know, a predator is a predator.
Yeah, that's
a
good
point. They will find that weak personality that they can mold and take over their mind. And I think that was what they did.
You need
here.
A place to sleep, huh? You need a place. You need something to eat, baby?
So, because when he
catch you a trout,
when he first meets her, do you think that he's already been like scoping this girl out? Because he walks up to her.
No, he's just such a smooth motherfucker. He's like, I'm going to trap this girl. But that's also hey, baby, you want to go for a walk?
I mean, like what Gary says, I believe that that's true, right? But I don't think that it's like an overt, like conscious thing. It's like, it's just how that personality type operates, you know, it's like, and people just kind of fall into it. It's not like he's out there scoping, you know, cause this is my master plan. Yeah. It's like, he has no plan at all except to just be, you know, free basically. Free, like I'm in love with this girl and I just wanted her and I to, you know, exist together. And it's too bad that her dad got in the way and I had to shoot him. And now the law wants us and they're never going to let us alone. And I'm just going to, you know, the dream of the whole movie is that he's going to drive up to the mountains and get a job
in a coal mine.
Yeah. Like, that's how this is supposed to end in his mind, his fantasy. You know, it was like, but the body count is ratcheted up so high at that point that the state troopers and the National Guard are all on their case.
I do like the fact that, like most movies, you fucking kill somebody, you drive around town, you do what you need to do. I like how this movie is like they kill somebody and automatically. You know, you can't go on the roads. You know, they'll probably have roadblocks. They'll have whatever. So I like how this movie really feels like you don't just fucking kill someone and then just, like, leave state or something like that. It really takes some maneuvering and some, like, you know, whatever just to get out of this one location. I like how this movie does a good job at making you feel like you're trapped in fucking North Dakota or wherever you're at.
Well,
like,
they're out pilfering gas that's leaking off of pipelines.
That was kind of cool. I was like, do people do this? Like, was that from fucking Jack Kerouac book or some shit like that? Yeah. Like, that was awesome.
See, that's also what this kind of brings to mind. I guess it is like that kind of...
On the road?
Yeah, I mean, because they leave the road and go off into the desert. That's how they're trying to avoid the cops, is they just drive into the fucking desert.
They just follow these power lines. Yep.
A lot of time, you know, just off the beaten path, like out in the wilderness, you know, and it kind of does bring to mind, like, you know, these, you know, the on the road with Kerouac, you know, just kind of like bumping into different people. Of course, well, in this case, they killed them, but, you know, just kind of like it has this really heavy atmosphere, which I guess, you know, beyond the character of the protagonists. Just the movie itself has this really thick atmosphere of like Americana, you know. I mean, it has like this kind of, and I guess the only thing it feels like a Kerouacian, you know, vision of what like America is. It's like here on the open road, the guy looks like a cowboy. He's always dressed in, you know, this blue denim. At one point, he says he's going to be a cowboy. That was his next job.
He worked at the feed lot or whatever.
Yeah, he started doing that. Yeah,
but by kind of matching up like that iconography with that idea in your head that like this is, you know, cowboy. He looks like a cowboy. He's wearing cowboy boots all the time. Like, it's like that's the thing that, you know, that his identifying, like, not trademark, but, you know, like visual signatures. These crazy, ridiculous cowboy boots. Like,
yeah,
you know,
they're white.
And so then I'm like, you know, it's like you've got that with the cowboy, and then you've got like the American outlaw, you know, the outlaw. And it's like together somehow that like puts together, at least in my mind, this like, you know, see, I don't even want to say it's like 50s America, but it really does seem like it's going after this like, you know, really atmospheric. Not American Dream. I don't know where I'm going with this.
Like
I'm really,
because
I can't lock it down.
Well, like she said, it's that kid from the wrong side of the tracks. And I think that's when that became popular. That terminology, anyway, was in the 50s. You had the greasers and the soldiers again. But outsiders, you know, kind of that feel.
Well, Outsiders also has this feeling that I guess I'm saying that this movie captures. It's like a specific period of time, and like
it's a more innocent time, but even then it could be corrupted.
Maybe with this. Maybe it's like it's a quintessential, like, you know, it's this America that I'm not even sure existed, but exists in our collective consciousness. Yeah.
Well, that's what it is, because she's reading the celebrity tabloid or whatever with rumored and truth about all the celebrities, which is kind of the idea of this film. Like, he's the James Dean character. He's taken on this persona of something that Hollywood or show business has, you know, fed out there, or, you know, given out there for us to feed off of in the 50s. And it's...
See, I don't know if I see what you're saying, and I agree that the elements of that are there, you know, but it doesn't seem like he sees himself that way. It's more like that's how
he's,
you know,
portrayed.
Because it's the cop who says, you know who that guy looks like?
I don't know.
Looks like James Dean.
I was afraid.
But when he's like,
weather.
Hey, you want my lighter? You want? I think he totally digs attention an American criminal is going to get, and like, he's trying to get off. Like, hell, he was actually offended when the cop, like, threw his hat out the window. You know, he thought he could sit there and josh around with these guys. Like, oh, sorry about that. You know, we had ourselves a little hoo-ha,
you know. You guys were total heroes back there. And don't think I won't tell him when we get back to town. He's like, you know what? I did my thing. And that's it. I'm busted. You guys are doing your jobs. And you're doing it the best that you can. And I appreciate the treatment. So then that's actually what we need to talk about is in the movie. Where I think that it was like, what in the hell happened? When the cops actually bust him, they take him back to, like, in the National Guard.
It's a hangar.
Hangar base.
Airplane hangar.
And all of these cops are hanging around, like, interviewing. And it's like he's a celebrity, you know? Because everybody's like, hey, what'd you do with this, you know, kit? And blah, blah, blah. He's like, hey, I got this lighter. You want this lighter? I'll take the lighter. And he throws the lighter. And, like, you want this comb? And he's, like, just kind of casually talking. He's shaking their hands as he's heading out. It's and the one guy is like... I wish you best of luck, kid. I really mean that. This like state trooper busted him.
Yeah, that was the thing. That was the most understanding police force I've ever seen. And the National Guard sitting around, they're all having yucks about Kit.
Well, because they know he's going to go to the electric chair. You know, they're right. Well, why even, like, kick him?
And the one sheriff, when they arrest him, they're like, man, look, he's as tall as I am. Like, he's been made.
Nothing.
Yeah. They make him out to be this, you know, huge, iconic criminal.
Like, and they did in, well... You can't be William Wallace. William Wallace is 6 feet 11 inches.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's, same thing. It's a hero, an iconic image, I guess.
Now, time to actually catch him.
Bad killer.
He's become a celebrity.
But see, I guess that's my point. I think that I don't necessarily think that it doesn't feel like he goes to the movies or is really aware of pop culture.
No.
You know, like heavily influenced by it. He knows it's out there, but like he's living in the fucking woods and just doing this to get by. And because the movie spends so much time in their perspective, all of this stuff that we assume, I think like a lot of this happens in our, the viewer's heads. We realize through what she's saying that like, holy shit, there's like, huge manhunt going on for these people. They're probably like in all the newspapers, you know, they're talking about how, you know, sidewalks were rolled up and kids were taken to school
under armed guard. And
and so we don't actually meet the people who are like, you know, the crazy, you know, like celebrity sycophants who are like, oh, Kit, you know, whatever. But we realize that they must be out there, that this has become like he's become a media celebrity. And it's only when he gets caught and he's in the hangar with all these troops that you're like, and they're treating him the way that they are. It's because they've been fed this, you know, the media has given them this inflated idea of what the guy is like. And now he's like, and you're like James Dean. So they're assigning that to him more than he's exploiting it.
Yeah. But I think he likes it and he continues. Because, I mean, you know, they don't, they say it two times in the movie. You look like James Dean. The first time's at the beginning or near the beginning. Yeah.
Okay,
it was two times. That's why I knew. I was like, this fucking character. I think Sissy Spacek said it.
Well, she narrated it.
Yeah.
But I think someone said it to his face, though.
That's right.
He has someone say it to his face two times in the movie, and he always, like, gets that smile. It's like the only time he smiles in the fucking movie. So when someone tells him he looks like James Dean. I mean, I think even though the movie doesn't show it, I do think Brent's right. I think this character is a type of character that I'm not saying he watches movies. I'm just saying that. Okay, imagine you are this character. It's 1959. Mm-hmm. What are the TV shows he would watch? It's all the Western shows. It's all the... And, like, I mean, that's what I've always liked about these type of criminal movies is because we're talking about a time when... I mean, shit. I mean, you had a good chance at getting away with murder before the 40s, you know? Even with a car, just get away, you know? There's no helicopter. There's no fucking fingerprints. There's no, you know?
Yeah.
So it was still that outlaw West thing that you can fucking do what you want. And, oh, there might be some guys trying to catch you, but, you know, stay one step ahead of them.
Head to Canada or Mexico.
But these are the times where it's like that shit was getting more, you know, it was harder to do. It was harder just to get away with something and, you know, so it's all about.
But do you think, like, again, maybe because I've made the connection on it, can I get it out of my mind where I see, like, Natural Born Killers was, like, a reaction to this movie. That's what it feels like. Because the whole.
This is, like, 30 years later. Like, I mean, Quentin Tarantino wanted to.
Like, took this movie. Yeah, but that's just turned it to the more violent.
But I think this guy took Rebel Without a Cause and obsessed. You know what I'm saying?
But I'm talking about, like, the media fascination with the killers. Like, the way that.
But that's the Dillinger. That's what we do in real life.
Yeah, well, Mickey and Mallory are hyper aware that they are celebrities. Like, the whole time. And that's why I say I think that this feels different. Like, he doesn't seem like a terribly pop culture savvy character, Kit, in this. Whereas Mickey and Mallory seem very savvy of, like, we watch TV all the time. We want to be those characters on TV. And this is who we're acting out by being.
Telling you, man, he smiles. You say James Dean. Yeah, but that's this just because he's don't make excuses want to not believe it. I'm saying he smiles.
He didn't seem like he was a product of, watching TV 24/7.
Well, but that's just like because I doubt. Like, in today's movie-making world, it is a novelty that, hey, we sit around and watch movies, we're going to get characters that sit around and watch movies. I'm sure movies that were made in the 70s, you weren't necessarily getting that sort of, like, look in on our own culture or whatever. You know, they didn't necessarily. So
I mean, I don't think that they. See, I wonder if that's what this was, but for its period of time.
Yeah, because maybe. It's like. Because I don't. I mean, I can't necessarily recall any movie from the 60s. This is 73.
Yeah.
I can't really recall any movies from that time that look at movie watching as a culture, because they're in the moment, right?
Yeah,
they are making
the movies.
Yeah, they can't necessarily. I mean, yeah, they could be reflective about some 20. Well, because I like how he did music. Oh, Nat King Cole, he did
big music
greaser guy or whatever the fuck, right?
Yeah,
but like he had to pull over to dance to Nat King Cole. Like, oh shit, no, don't touch it with.
That was a nice romantic moment.
Oh, not in her face. Well, look at her face. She's like that.
I want to get out of here.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. Oh, that's what I liked about that scene.
Is it romantic or is it awkward? Because I couldn't figure it out.
It's called a hostage situation.
It felt very
point.
Stiff.
Yeah.
It felt like, and I don't know sometimes if it's just Sissy SpaceX acting or not, but there was an awkwardness on her face.
Well, what did they say right before? Because it was important what they said right before he heard what was on the radio. Because then when they're outside dancing, he's like, if I could tell you how I felt or something like that.
She was telling him that he's not going to be able to get a license.
Yeah. She's like giving the harsh reality of like our little fucking. Our little plan is not necessarily, you know, we don't necessarily have an out of this, you know. You can't just go get a job of something you're not qualified to do. And he's like, well, I've got boots on. I can wear jackets.
I can shoot.
I can shoot.
Because that's always popular in a coal mine. That's what you want to shoot where there's gases around.
No, you got
to
shoot the other people so they're free up the jobs. Exactly.
You want to move up.
I heard there's an opening.
Yeah. Well, like with Kit, for me, I got a more, I guess, simplistic view of him. This is a kid who's had no power his whole life. He's been nothing. I mean, he didn't even. Where did he live? I mean, he was just on a garbage truck.
He was not from South Dakota. He didn't seem like he was a native there.
It didn't show anything that he ever had anything in his life, had no power. Now all of a sudden he's got a gun, he's got some power, and now he's got a little bit of celebrity going. And I think now he's finally, for the first time in his life, being noticed by anybody.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that kind of, you know, shines through in his character to me anyway.
Well, but he definitely had something in his mind the whole time. That's why I won't look past the idea that he wanted to be something, because right from the get-go, he's like, well, we're going to have passwords that change every day. We're going to have, I mean, he had it all down.
I think right in the beginning of the film, I think when they go for their first walk, he sees a piece of trash in the ground on the sidewalk. Yeah. He's like, if everybody did that, the whole place would be filled with garbage. I think that's an idea of the film. I mean, he is that whoever littered that piece of trash. Like, he knows not everyone's going to do this. You know, so if he chooses the life of crime, you know, takes this girl with him, and he can beat all them because not everyone's doing this. He's, you know, he's treating these people. He's like, it's America's his playground, you know, as he goes from like, from what did I say, woods to ranch.
You're climbing the social.
From the first time he crawled out of the primordial ooze to the up in the castle. But yeah, no, I get what you're saying. Yeah.
It was to the oil
tower or whatever.
Oh my God, it all connects to the oil.
It's the oil.
That's when they get shut down.
Yeah.
Can't get past the oil barons. Son of a bitch. I love it when she's going to turn herself in. I thought that was awesome. I like how she just sits down. She's like, nope, I'm not going.
He's like, what? I just can't understand people like
I'm Emilio Estevez now.
And that's where I thought he was going to break his thing to the dad. His promise to her dad was, you know, well, she wanted to go. I just let her go. And I thought he was going to flip.
Yeah, I thought he was going to get a little possessive. But,
yeah.
But it was cool. I was just like, if you want a second chance. I like that. That was awesome. That's a cool fucking like edgy rebel thing.
Yeah,
like,
that is a cool thing.
Can't argue with you.
Yeah.
But if you change your mind, meet me here.
Yeah, meet me at this date. What was that, New Year's Eve?
At a bridge or a dam or something. Yeah.
Something like that. 1964 that was cool.
Or something. Yeah.
That's why I get the impression that he really did love her. It wasn't like, you know, because I guess, you know, if you think of it, he's going to go like, well you're not coming with me.
Her.
Bam.
Yeah, you know, I've killed everything else that got in my way.
Maybe he loved her.
But I didn't get the impression
that she loved him.
I don't know if she loved him, but I think she had great affection for
him. I mean,
you know, because I think that comes across in the way that she talks about him in the voiceover.
I just think it comes from the whole, like, it's just the whole, like, student-teacher relationship. You know, he's 10 years older, he's got the gun, the power, you know, she's in love with that. Not necessarily him, the man, him, the authority figure, him, the protector, you know.
Well, and a 15-year-old girl is always in love with the idea of being in love, so there's that factored in as well.
Yeah, oh well, yeah, because that is definitely coming into this.
That's for sure.
Well, I guess I will start the wrap-ups of this evening.
Start us off.
My wrap-up of the Badlands. I like this movie. Like, there's not a lot of movies I could compare this to, except for, like, I would compare this to, like, Dog Day Afternoon. Just that kind of, like, you're in this real crime situation. It's not, like, crazy action. It's not even, like, crazy suspense. But you got those moments where you're like, oh, yeah, you know, this is you know, the part that you know, they're going to get home or, you know. I've always liked 70s. I keep on wanting to say true crime just because it feels like true crime to me. It's not necessarily detective noir or nothing like that, but just... Right. Just the idea of just like people in the Midwest, especially, you know, it's not New York, Chicago, LA, you know, you're just somewhere in America, you know, fucking breaking laws and, you know, and I like the music in this. I mean, this is the type of movie that, I mean, it will lull you to sleep if you don't watch it under the right, like, circumstances. If you're like, even like, I'm gonna drink some wine to this movie, or, you know, I mean, this movie can make you go to sleep just because, yeah, you're just watching it, that's, listening to it.
I think that's true with all of Terrence Malick's films.
Yeah, that's true with Godzilla movies. You just there's certain movies that are like, this is awesome, but if it catches you at that right, like, time, it's just like, this is a perfect recipe for sleep. But I don't even know how many movies I've seen with Martin Sheen in it, but I liked him in this. I thought he was pretty cool.
Was this his first movie? Anybody know?
I don't know. I don't think it said anything about introducing him.
Because this is Sissy Spacek before Carrie,
the
one that made her like super famous.
Right.
But, I mean, so... Is there anything else I really want to say about it? I think we really, like, talked a lot about it. I mean... It could have been, I don't know, maybe a tad shorter, just because there is a lot of just looking at nature, which I guess you're supposed to be thinking about stuff or whatever. Maybe I'm just not that deep.
It's only 94
maybe
minutes.
I didn't smoke enough weed. Was it only 94 minutes?
It's only 94.
I mean, that's how, like, little things happen in this movie. Like, not a lot happens in this movie.
It's slow.
I think the music helps that. The music helps that a lot. The music gets you through all that shit, and it's not boring. This movie doesn't feel boring. It's, yeah, there's nothing happening, but I don't think it feels boring. Sissy Spacek is a delight as always. And I recommend this movie. That's the end of my wrap up.
That's one. Gary took a bunch of notes during the film, so.
Well, I did enjoy the movie. It did transport me back to that time. I did feel like I was back in that era. Martin Sheen, I love him as an actor. There were a couple of things, but they were minor things. You and I discussed during the film, the animals were a little off because the llamas aren't really known for wandering through South Dakota, but it could have been on a farm. I'll even give it that. Right. Just a few little things like that. But other than that, I really enjoyed the movie. I thought I would be more taken out of it by her father's character. Because all I'm seeing is
Warren Oates.
Yeah, all I'm seeing is the sergeant from Stripes every time. That's who I'm hearing when I'm listening to his voice.
Like, how do you make that connection?
Sergeant Hulka.
I saw the guy from Dixie Dynamite, but that's right.
But Dynamite. There were a couple times, and again, not Sheen's performance. I love him as an actor. My favorite portrayal of his is General Lee in Gettysburg. That's my favorite performance of his.
Wow.
I also loved him in The Departed. But there were a couple
times. Apocalypse again, Now.
Apocalypse Now was a fantastic movie.
You're a cult leader for that movie.
The only thing is, seeing him that young, because, I mean, even in Apocalypse Now, he's a little older than what he was here. Mm. But seeing him that young, exactly, it's like you take Charlie and Emilio and smash their faces together, and there's Dad.
Dude.
And that's exactly what I was saying.
He raises his voice. He's Emilio.
Exactly.
It's so funny.
And he pulls, like I said during the movie, when he pulled off that, how'd that be? Well, that's listening to Billy the Kid from Young Guns. You know, you can hear it.
Yeah.
But a fantastic movie. I enjoyed Sissy Spacek's performance. She definitely brought up across that portrayal of a young, innocent girl that got caught up in something that she thought was going to be something completely else, this romance that turned violent, and then she just got drug along. And I think, you know, her family dynamic with her and her father played into that. Sheen definitely gives it that charming portrayal, just like most, you know, guys like Bundy. Bundy was very charming. You know, the lawyers loved him. I mean, he was a charming guy. Even some of the witnesses, how charming he was. The judge said, you know, and that's how these characters are. And again, like I said, they know what to look for, and he found the perfect partner in Sissy Spacek. I just don't think she was as committed to it. And he did say at one point, I always wanted to be a criminal, just not this big a one. So, you know, but still, it was a good movie. I really enjoyed it. I honestly, when I first heard about it, I was kind of looking up a few things about it. I'm like, but it really won me over. I would recommend the movie, but it is a period piece. So understand that and just enjoy it. It's a great movie. I did like it. So thanks for the experience.
Cool. Two for two. Thank you for coming back.
Oh, no problem. Anytime.
Well, I mean, this is we were outside right before we had a little smoke break after the movie before coming in.
That's
here.
Not a
little
bit.
And and Travis was talking about how this was you know, it felt like an art house movie, and I was reflecting on the fact that, like, back in 1973 when this came out, this wasn't art house. This was like mainstream. Like, you know, you had a theater in your town.
No, but I'm saying what exactly? That's what I'm saying. You're confusing my use of the word art house. I use art house when I just mean artsy fartsy. When I mean, like, because, like I said, what movies from the early 70s have those, like, close up still images of, you know, I mean, I don't see that a lot.
So Travis is saying he's not seeing a movie, he's seeing a film, you know?
But I guess
that's what the distinction
I mean, that's
why
I just don't
there.
Think it was so, like, all the filmmakers were doing. I don't, or else he wouldn't be so special, right?
Okay, so,
I mean,
well, let me change that. Then I guess maybe what it was. I guess that maybe what I took out, you know, from like art house was that this is a movie that takes its time, kind of unraveling its story. It's a movie that's about characters more than plot, and so it is about, you know, like the iconography of, like, what they, you know, they look like and represent. And then, you know, it's beautiful vistas and, you know, everything's, like, carefully composed and stuff like that. I mean, but at the same time, it does kind of feel like you're catching the performances on the fly. I mean, on the back of the box, it says, like, these idiosyncratic performances by these people, which is kind of like the reason that the cop shot that gun, you know, as he's walking back. It was just like they would do weird things that make them feel human, where it does kind of feel like you're just catching people as they are. That scene where he's fishing, you know, I'm like, how long did they have to sit there with cameras, with the film burning, to try and get him to actually catch a fish? You know, it's like, so it's that slice of life kind of thing. I just saw a movie called Sorcerer, William Friedkin from 75, 76, 77, something like that. But I guess what it goes back to is like what feels like what now, if somebody made a movie like that today, it would play in an art house movie theater.
Yeah.
And it's not coming to your multiplex because it can't push out Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and everything else that's playing there. This would go to an art house theater. In 1973, this was your mainstream, you know, this was what movies were doing. And what I like to say is, I know I have twisted what you meant, but I guess the thing that I like about 70s film is it feels like the 70s were, I know they say like maybe like the golden age of Hollywood was like when films were, you know, like the 30s and the 40s and, you know, the talkies and like we'd actually figured out how to do stuff like Cat in a Hot Tin Roof or, you know, so On the Waterfront or something like that.
Falcon, all those. Yeah.
But to me, like movies actually became movies. Like, I'm sorry, the older films were doing things with drama that carried over. But I still think now looking back on it, those were still stepping stones. And I'm not trying to, God knows, I'm not trying to diminish anything that was done prior to 1970. No, but I mean, there's people out there who love, you know, and I love them too. But I'm just saying that, you know, we stepped into the color era in the 1970s where like most movies were made in color. I mean, in the 60s, it was still like, it was hit or miss. You know, I mean, it was like, this movie's in color. I mean, they still had to advertise, you know, in color, you know, in case you didn't know. But the way that cinema had evolved, it's like the 70s were like the perfect storm. People were doing stuff that wasn't all just these kind of stagey Hollywood, what Hollywood had been doing productions, and started doing stuff. I mean, like, this is where you get like your Easy Rider. It's where you get your Godfather. It's where you get, you know, like Rocky. I mean, like all of these
stuff. But I want to say there was a lot of trash because of how experimental filmmakers were back then, though. I mean, that's why I have like, I don't know, shit like the Billy Jack movie. Like, those are okay movies. They're okay movies. But man, so they're just a little like they're practicing what they can do with
yeah, well,
it's definitely got the counterculture composition
with the camera, with the timeline.
Yeah, well, what you would call the timeline of a story, goddammit.
Oh, okay, the chronology.
Story structure or something like that. Like how, because I mean, if you watch Billy Jack, they stop the movie and they literally show these hippies teach a fucking class on like using your imagination. And like, who thought this was a good idea to put this in the middle of a movie? Yeah. Like,
but that's what I like about it. I mean, this still feels like this is experimental, you know, to a point, even probably at the time. I mean, but that's where you had guys like, you know, it felt like, you know, it really was the filmmaker's medium and not like, you know, you're Michael Bay and you can blow shit up better than anybody else. It's like you're doing stuff here that I think means more to the viewing, you know, the viewer. You're trying to create some kind of, you know,
I think I guess this goes back to a good story, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, in telling a good story, you're trying to basically get some kind of emotional response or some kind of, you're trying to involve the audience in the plight of the people in the movie more than like now, where it's like, you know, you just kind of go by rote, kind of. It's like, this person is this type, and this is what's happening to him. And they got that kid, the guy in Godzilla has to carry the kid in because that's how we have to know. Because the movie's not concerned about the people at all. It's concerned about the special effects of, you know, the giant lizard stomping the...
Yeah, they definitely brought that through, and that was with... you did feel, like I said, you felt the romance heat up, peak, and then start to die out, but you could feel for the characters. You felt like Sissy Spacek knew she was in over her head. Mm. He knew that this was going to end badly for him, and you just had to go along for the ride and see where it ended. So that's what I liked about it.
But, yeah, I like this type of storytelling. I like it even when people do it nowadays, and unfortunately, like I said, it's relegated to, you know, the art house, and eventually you see it come around, you know, like months after the fact. But yeah, I mean, the performances, I think, feel very naturalistic. I mean, Martin Sheen was a movie star. You know, I mean, when you're watching it, it's like, that guy's got it. He's got the thing, you know, he's got that movie star thing.
He's got the X factor.
Yeah. I think it's probably, now having seen it, I want to say it's probably my favorite Terrence Malick film, you know, maybe because, you know, as I was talking about before, he developed this style that I'm not entirely comfortable with, you know, the Thin Red Line. I like the New World, but I mean, it still feels like it's wandering. And that's, I think, his thing now is they wander. This one felt more like, at least, even though it was wandering, it's still, compared to his other stuff, feels more on point.
Yeah.
You know, so I think, yeah, I would definitely recommend this movie. I think it's, I was going to say, like, it's a classic. No, like, you have to see it. Like, well, you know.
I'd say it's a 70s classic. I mean, I'm a little lukewarm to a lot of 70s stuff. You know, if it's not just like hardcore gore, hard, you know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. I'd say it's a really good movie.
Yeah, that's maybe the best thing that you can say, but it is a really good movie. I can't really find a fault in it. The only people who are going to find faults in it, I think, are people who say that it's slow. And for that, you know, I have sympathy. It's like, I think it's absorbing, you know.
Yeah.
And, but that's me. So
you just got to be in the right mindset, man.
All right. I just want to point out that this is the second week in a row that I'm getting, or second turn in a row that everybody liked Brent's film. That's me. So that's cool. I love this movie. I'm going to make this short and sweet because I kind of got to pee. But looking at this film, again, like, this is the second time I've seen it within a week. But it's interesting to see a director from the 70s doing a period piece. You know, they always say, like, it takes like 10 years to, or I don't know if they say this, but
I say,
as I've always said,
I've never worked in Hollywood, but what I say,
it takes like what, like a decade to recognize what the decade before it was all about, right? I mean, that would be fair to say, I think. So looking at a director from 73, looking at, you know, a story set in 1959, it's interesting the comments that he can make on that time period, you know, where maybe, I don't know how old Terrence Malick was when he made this, but maybe he was growing up in the 50s and he is seeing this whole Americana now with the perspective of 14 years. And having this chance to take, you know, it's such a great idea. And I think it's like, okay, I'm going to equate it to, or compare it to No Country for Old Men, how you have modern day, you know, relatively modern day directors telling a story that takes place in the 80s. It's another, you know, crime spree on the road kind of drama. And just kind of looking back at what, you know, I think that film's an Americana for, you know, like for the 80s, where this is for 50s. I don't know where I was going with that. I lost it.
How a director is 10 years, it takes 10 years to figure out what's going on in that era.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. So like Malick takes this Bonnie and Clyde type story, and he's able to without any exposition and very little plot, he's able to comment on so much, you know, like you're definitely, you feel, cause it's written, produced and directed by Terrence Malick, and you get the feeling that this is one man trying to talk to you, but it's almost in code. Like you have to figure it out. Like, I think I need to watch this more and more. And each time I'll discover more. And just talking with you guys, I think that I'm learning more about the film, you know, and like the ideas behind it.
I like Brent because he wants movies to be like these in-depth, like, I, like you want to, like, is this a puzzle for me? Like,
well, yeah.
But that's part of the joy of movies, mm-hmm. I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is. And I think, like, it always surprises me because I'm not one that picks up on it the first viewing. It might take, like, five viewings till I'm like, oh, wait a second, but they meant that. You know, like, I'll figure it out eventually, but I'm not the quickest guy in that picking up on what the director is trying to say, you know, like, between the lines or the underlying themes of the film. But this one, I think, is pretty blatant out there, and it fascinates me that they're able to do it, because like The Deer Hunter, there's very little exposition in this film. Like, you're just watching these characters. You do have a narration in this,
also a 70s movie,
also a 70s movie. the narration, I think, helps you along with that. And like Travis was saying, the music helps you along with that. But you can see that this is the start of this guy's going to be something. It's strange that we didn't see him for the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm. He's busy writing Dirty Harry.
That's right. Holy shit. Yeah. Because that was 73. That was also like 73.
Mm-hmm. That's what I'm talking about. That's why I don't think he's some deep artist. He just likes fucking American action. Yeah. He just wants guns blazing and...
Well,
it's just a different time. He just made that movie a little artsy.
I mean, it's too much of a coincidence, you know, because like watching this film, you can see that style is already being born in this film. The style that you see in Thin Red Line, you see it in A New World, you see it in Tree of Life. I feel like we're missing one.
It does feel like there's one.
Is there one more?
But I think it's something that we didn't see. That's probably with Ben Affleck in it.
Yeah,
like, probably. I think it has Ben Affleck. I'll look it up. I'll have it for you.
Okay. Please don't say that. And the characters are like going back to the whole James Dean thing. I believe that Martin Sheen's character, that Kit, I think that he is aware of James Dean. I think that James Dean is like maybe the only celebrity that he can identify with. But I think like he was James Dean before James Dean. When did James Dean die? I feel like I was saying
James Dean. No, he wasn't James Dean before James Dean because people were telling him he's James Dean.
Well, right. But
he has to be James Dean. I don't know when the fuck
James Dean. I mean, when James Dean.
I think before 59. I don't know.
I'm thinking like when he discovered James Dean, you know, like watching TV, like he's like, yes, that's what I'm trying to say. Like, that's me.
That would have been James. The Rebel Without a Cause was like. It could have been 58. 54. It's either 54 or 58, I want to say. It's one of them.
I don't think it was 58. That seems a little late.
Too late?
Yeah.
So he's dead by then? Giant and whatever the other one he did?
Yeah, because he was only in, what, three movies?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because it was his death that made him, like, so famous, right?
Well, I mean, he was a young...
Wow. Yeah. To the Wonder is 2012?
Yeah, I'm like, I think it has Ben Affleck in it, but I totally missed it.
Yeah.
But he went from Badlands, 73, Days of Heaven, 78, Thin Red Line, 1998. Yeah. 20 fucking years.
20 years.
Had nothing to say.
Yeah. And now he's like making movies like all the time.
I got all kinds of things to say. Nobody wants to listen. So.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I said I was going to make this short. I recommend it. Check out Badlands, especially if you're a fan of the other Terrence Malick flicks that are out there, the few. This one is probably, I might say it's my favorite. And I got lucky because I was watching it on a hunch. But go out there, watch it. You can get the Criterion Collection from Amazon.
Don't fucking plug Amazon.
They're not paying us.
We
got to get a link.
Yeah.
But yeah, go out there, watch it, love it.
All right, so that's Badlands on the Saturday Night Freak Show, a 4-for-4, so that's a good batting average. Next week, I guess then it's my movie. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be next week. Whatever. Next episode is that's my movie, forever. And we are going to watch Art House Meets the Grindhouse with Daughters of Darkness, a movie from 1971.
A lesbian vampire movie?
Lesbian vampires!
Hell.
There you go. So that's next Saturday Night Freak Show, and until then... The basement is closed.
Let's all go to the bathroom.
See, the reason I'm saying that's not like other...